you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week, you know him, you love him, he loves Superman, which is why he's here, Michael Bailey. Hi, Michael.
Thanks a lot, Rob. You know, this episode's going to prove that there are lives, damn lies, and Superman salutes the Bicentennial.
Yeah, that's if you guys are listening to this on the day this episode drops, this is a special July 4th, a special Wednesday episode of Treasury Cast, and what other book could I be talking about than Superman salutes the Bicentennial? And I'm sure, Michael, that you are excited at the idea of 64 pages of Treasury-sized Superman adventures, am I right?
Oh, when I picked this thing up a couple of years ago, I saw it at a comic shop, and I'm like, that is a beautiful cover. I must have this, so I bought it, paid like 10 bucks for it, which I think is good for a Treasury these days.
Yes.
And got it home, and got through three pages, and then I heard the da-da-da-da,
Yes. Yeah, I was about to say, if you are excited at the notion of 64 pages of Superman Treasury comics, too bad this book isn't it. Because after the cover, which, as you mentioned, is beautiful, it's by Fred Ray. It features one of the great all-time Superman images of him in front of Captain America's first shield with the eagle flying on his arm. It's great. It's a beautiful cover. And then the inside cover is a little editorial by then-DC Comics president Saul Harris talking about the 1776 and the Bicentennial and Superman and Lois. And we get this intro, The Spirit of 1776, drawn by Kurt Swan, of course, is drawn by Kurt Swan. Superman giving us an intro, and he takes us through some parts of the Fortress of Solitude. And then we get to page four, and all of a sudden, this becomes a Tomahawk comic. And it stays a Tomahawk comic all the way until the very end. So this is one of the great bait and switches in all of comicdom. And I will admit, now I had this comic as a kid. You just said you bought it later on because you would have been too young to buy this off the stands. I can remember buying this comic and being pretty disappointed because at the age I was, I did not want to read boring Tomahawk stories. And except for one feature, which we'll get to near the end, I pretty much just dismissed this book as just like, it's a bunch of boring Tomahawk stuff. I know that I've gone on and on about Son of Tomahawk, which was the later iteration of, which I really love. But to me, the earlier Tomahawk stories are just dull as dishwater. And I always just thought this book was just a giant missed opportunity. But now I'm older, and I'm ready to give this book a little bit of a reappraisal. I'm still disappointed that it's not Superman stories, but there's some fun stuff here in these Tomahawk stories. But before we even get to all the Tomahawk stuff, I do want to mention, this features a line in the intro Superman has. It features one of my favorite lines he ever says, where he talks about going back into the past. He's going to give us the readers a view of the past. And he says, I don't need time projecting for myself. I can just break the time barrier at super speed and go to whatever time period I'm interested in. Like, that's how casual Superman was about that stuff back then.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you could look at that two different ways. You could look at it as him being benevolent that he has this device that allows you to do what he can do, or him just being kind of a little, you know, big-headed. It's just like, now me, I can just go do whatever I want, but you got to watch it on TV.
You puny meatbags have to look at this view screen. Meanwhile, I'm hanging out with Cleopatra at a moment's notice, if I feel like it. I go, okay, all right, Superman, you don't have to keep rubbing it in. I understand.
I think the funny thing is that you're not too terribly much older than I am. I was born in 76, so obviously I was way too young to be picking this up off the stands. But I think it's safe to say that our generation did not grow up on Davy Crockett. No. So a guy in a buckskin cap is not going to be our idea of something exciting. It's going to be more of, you know, Captain Kirk or, you know, other sci-fi or adventure stuff that we watched on television. So this was an odd thing to foist on the children of America in 1976.
I mean, they didn't even call it Superman and Tomahawk Salute the Bicentennial. It's Superman Salute. I mean, it's clear they're clearly trying to get you to believe a certain thing, and then they switch off and it becomes a whole other thing. But like I said, I'm willing to give this book a little bit of a reappraisal. So after Superman does the intro, we have a little one-pager of Tomahawk and his partner Dan Hunter saving the life of a guy out in the woods from a panther attack. And it turns out this guy's name is George Washington, which we think will probably become significant later on in history.
Yeah, this is the Forrest Gump part of the book where he, you know, it's funny that you mentioned giving it another shot. I when I got to the point several years ago when I bought this and saw that it was nothing but Tomahawk stories, I kind of put it back into the bag and kind of put it with all the other treasuries that I had. So this is actually the first time I read it. And I really didn't want to come from it with the, oh, this is the ultimate lie that DC has ever told us, because, boy, they've done a lot to, you know, kind of outdo that over the last couple of decades. But it's kind of funny that I read this first, you know, this first little thing, and I'm like, well, I can see where a kid in, like, the 50s and 60s might dig this. Because being a frontiersman at one point was just, like, the cool thing to be. So I tried to put myself in that position. It did not always save the story, but it made it at least more enjoyable to read the entire book.
Yeah, I mean, as we'll get to after we go through the stories, is Tomahawk was like a pretty big star for DC Comics. He appeared in multiple titles at one point. So obviously, yeah, kids that were watching Davy Crockett on TV and hearing this, this book seemed perfectly, you know, sellable. I mean, he was a big character. If you look at some of the house ads at the time, Tomahawk is in there. So, you know, yeah, he was one of DC's stars. Was he ever Superman or Batman? No, but he was pretty popular. So yeah, after the one pager that we have where he salutes, he meets General George Washington, saves his life, the first story is Adventure in New York from Star Spangled Comics number 121. General Washington gives Tomahawk and his sidekick Dan Hunter a mission to travel behind enemy lines to New York and procure a stash of ammunition to help with the war effort. All these stories are going to be drawn by Fred Ray, and who drew the cover, of course, of Superman. And I, again, when I first, you know, bought this comic as a kid, I just was like, ugh, whatever. And it took me a long time to kind of appreciate Fred Ray. But now that I feel like I'm older and I'm more sophisticated, I kind of look at this and I'm like, I really like a lot of this stuff. It has a slight Frazetta feel to it. I don't want to oversell that. But the way he inks, it's got a real, real solid anatomy, very solid storytelling. It's not terribly thrilling, but it's very consistent. It's very pleasing to the eye. And, like, I actually kind of like it. Like, you know, it doesn't gain much, I'd say, at the treasury size necessarily. But it's not bad.
Yeah, I really actually dug the artwork through most of the issue. It's not from an era that I would say that I feel comfortable, you know, like completely comfortable with, you know, just in terms of reading those stories. There's a lot of Golden and Silver Age stories that I've read that I'm like, wow, this is kind of a slog to get through. But what I kind of like about the artwork and the story itself is that the action is always impactful. Like when he punches that British officer for slapping Dan, it's just like you feel that, you know, it's not exactly like a Kirby hit, but it you know, there's some heft behind that. So I kind of dug that. And there's some shadowy work when he meets with the guys behind closed doors on the next page. Like the lighting on this page is really good. And you just have that one.
Right, because it's all candlelit, right.
Yeah. And you have this one, the one dude smoking the long pipe that you see in all of the movies from this era. And I just kind of got lost in that. I could kind of see this as like a film, not a film noir, basically, but I could see them kind of filming this and the lighting being like that. And then, you know, he meets up with the prisoners later in the story. And it's just like, this story is all over the place. It's outside, it's inside, it's night, it's day. I was just really kind of impressed with it. It's not that it's terribly like I was excited through the whole thing, but it's just like, wow, maybe I need to reappraise this. this whole thing. If this is where it's coming from, you said a little Frazetta. I think also in certain places, not like throughout, there's a little Joe Kubert as well in some of the line work.
I can see that. Yes, I can see that.
So if you're going to ape two guys, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the punch, because it does have a great moment where that guy, he slaps Dan Hunter and Tomahawk can't help himself and he punches the guy. And you actually get a thought balloon from Dan Hunter where he goes, "No, Tomahawk, you'll ruin everything." I love the idea that Tomahawk, even though he's ostensibly the Batman in this relationship, is kind of a hothead. Yeah. And even though they're presumably kind of undercover, he can't help himself from pacing the guy one because he slapped his sidekick. Like, I love that. I think you would never get that moment in a Batman and Robin comic.
No, he would have let it go and then got him back later. But no, this is a rough and tumble frontiersman. So he's not going to take your guff.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the reason it works is that it's short.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like eight pages. So it gets in and out very quickly. And again, I'm glad you mentioned that this goes all over the place, as you mentioned. It's day, it's night, it's outside, it's inside, it's on a boat. I mean, it's got all kinds of crazy, not crazy, but it moves at a brisk pace and it never settles into like a rut.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of, I was like, all right, this is, all right, I'm digging this. Okay, so we'll move on to the next one. We'll see if the next one is
I hope good, there's no racism.
Which is the Magic Tomahawk from Stardust Spinkle Comics number 126. As a reward for bravery, General Washington gives Tomahawk a special tomahawk made by Paul Revere himself. Later, an Indian chief named Three Eagles attempts to steal it, thinking it possesses magical properties. And this is one of the first stories that I think sets up a later formula for the Tomahawk stories, where George Washington is kind of like his Commissioner Gordon, where he's constantly reporting to George Washington and getting missions. You know, you're like, okay, here, do this, do that. Like, okay, George Washington, okay, thank you. But any of the Tomahawk stories where he is encountering Indian chiefs that are the bad guys, it gets a little dicey.
I was reading this and I'm like, yep, this would have been right at home in the era that it was published in. You would not be able to do this today.
No, probably not. I mean, Fred Ray doesn't go overboard with the caricatures of the Indian chief, but Three Eagles. There's a couple of panels where he looks a little grotesque, and I'm like, okay, they're kind of overdoing it a little. But still, the action sequences are pretty good. There's a point where Tomahawk kicks a lit fire over at Three Eagles' face, which I enjoy, and then they run away in the night. So the idea that the Tomahawk has sort of magical properties because it was forged by Paul Revere himself, that gets a little like, okay, we don't have to like layer that kind of stuff into it. And unfortunately, if you kept reading Tomahawk comics, like, he would eventually take on dinosaurs and crazy stuff like that. So I think this was they were hinting in those directions of like, oh, we can get a little fanciful if we want to. We don't have to just do dry adventure stories.
And this is very much, you could have taken this plot, updated it to Gotham City, and this could have been a Batman and Robin story from the same era.
Yes.
Just have it be another quasi-magic. I mean, you could have even said it was crafted by Paul Revere and Batman, and that would have fit within the Batman story. So Stan Lee once said that, you know, writing stories isn't complicated. If you write a Western, you say, follow that stagecoach, and then instead of follow that car. I think there's a little more to it than that in terms of wanting to be authentic to the time period. But the plots of these are pretty, I mean, they're essentially, this is a war story. When you really kind of, you know, it's got that kind of Western feel to it and that frontiersman, but this is set during the Revolutionary War. So it's kind of a mixing of genres, which was another area where I was just like, wow, maybe there is more to this than I thought there was.
Mm-hmm. The next feature is a presumably a bonus feature that was specific to the Treasury. Now, it's clearly a reprint because at the very bottom of page one, it says copyright 1951 Frederick Ray.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I could not find any historical data on this. I'm guessing since we did learn, I learned in my research about Fred Ray that he did a lot of historical art. I mean, aside from doing comic book work, he did a lot of regular freelance illustration and a lot of historical stuff. I mean, that was a specialty that these guys did. And so this is probably from some other job that he did, so maybe a portfolio he had. I don't know. Like I said, it's dated 1951, so presumably it's from that time. And it's just this series. It's not even titled, but it's a series of one-page illustrations chronicling big events in the Revolution. And this is one of those things that why I love the treasuries as much as I do, is like, were these bonus features? Because where else would you see this? Now, maybe this ran in a Tomahawk comic or something. I don't know. But these drawings, these one-page drawings, are really beautiful.
This was my favorite part of the treasury, in all honesty. Yeah. I just thought, I agree with you. They are gorgeous one-page illustrations. They're very kind of scratchy, but that really fits in with the historical nature of it. And, you know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, about 2 hours north of Philadelphia. So that one page of George Washington, the day before Christmas, Washington having seen the provisions for the shelter of his army were well underway. I look at that house and I'm like, yep, seen houses like that all over the place growing up.
Yep. So that's a beautiful drawing.
It's just everything about this part. I actually was just like gobsmacked. Like, wow. The text is, you know, this is obviously for kids. For a younger audience. But I think it gives a pretty good overview of, you know, like the bullet points of the Revolutionary War. So, you know, it's just, and on that first page, you see the guy with the cane, with the long hair. I'm assuming that's supposed to be Benjamin Franklin.
I would assume so, yeah.
But, you know, it's just like I see this and I just want to rip out my DVD of 1776 and watch it again.
Yeah, they're really, really beautiful. There's one of them is a double page spread, and you see the U.S. Army fighting in the snow. I mean, they're really, really nice. So I love that they made the effort to dig these up. And this is actually the longest feature in the book. There's about 10 pages of this stuff, and it's really nice. I love the fact that they took the time to do this. And it's interesting that the DC chose to make this book virtually like a Fred Ray special.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Fred Ray cover. All the stories of Tomahawk are drawn by Fred Ray. This center page, the center spread feature is by Fred Ray. The only stuff that's not are the couple of pages by Kurt Swan of Superman. But this is like almost like the DC art of Fred Ray treasury.
And this is where the treasury size really, you know, makes the artwork pop, because it's not just a regular comic book size. You really get to see the scope of the artwork. And I, you know, just, you know, that second to last one of all the soldiers kind of raising their swords to Washington and him taking his cap off. I mean, it's just, I was like, wow, I have been making fun of this treasury for years and I've been an idiot this entire time, because there's really some cool stuff in here.
Even
the next story, which is weird.
Yes. Yeah. The next story is the first sub from Tomahawk number 45. Tomahawk and Dan Hunter try out America's newest secret weapon, a submersible craft called the Turtle. When news of possible collusion between the Redcoats and some local tribe services, the Turtle is pressed into service with Tomahawk inside. And I should mention, all these stories feature very awkward paste-ups of Superman in a little bubble introducing the story, as if we couldn't figure it out for ourselves. So this is another one of these where they're trying to tip Tomahawk into some genres that he would not have normally ventured into, like if there was a Tomahawk TV series, because there's a bunch of scenes of him in this little submersible, which looks really cool. It's got that kind of old timey style and then looking at the porthole and stuff like that. But I mean, obviously, you know, there was no such craft made at this time, but you know, you got to just go with it.
My favorite part, diagram of the Turtle. You know, it was a DC book from the 50s. They were going to diagram any vehicle that they introduced or headquarters, and I just love that stuff. So, yeah.
What the hell's this thing's Who's Who page?
We'll get Zoom right on that.
Exactly.
Actually, I would love to see that, but that's entirely beside the point.
Yes.
No, I mean, there were ideas of submarines. I know that, especially during the Civil War, I forget the name of it, but there was one that they uncovered years ago. But this wasn't going to work. I just love the fact that they have to basically come up to get all the carbon dioxide out of the vehicle because, we've got to get the clean air in here. It's like, I guess that really doesn't have a proper filtration system for the oxygen and carbon dioxide. But at the very end, Dan and Tomahawk just ride off in their little submersible.
Yeah, I don't know whether the Turtle ever made another appearance or anything like that, but it would might have been. I mean, they really are venturing into G.I. Joe territory now, where he had all these different crafts. But again, beautifully drawn by Fred Ray. I love the next to last panel of the Turtle kicking up all the sand on the bottom of the ocean, and he's shaking off all the Native Americans as they're trying to get into this. It's a really beautiful panel. Again, it's this Fred Ray guy. You know, I'm sure. I mean, he knew he was good. It's I'm sure he wasn't waiting for two knuckleheads 40 years later to discover. But man, this guy's really good.
I love the idea of the Native American warriors jumping into the water and hitting the submersible with their tomahawks. That's just such a weird concept, but I guess, you know, they don't really know what it is. So
it's like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. They think it's a sea monster or something. So the next story is Frontier Theater from Star Spangled Comics number 127. Tomahawk befriends two local actors who were recently booed off stage after appearing in a bad play. He enlists them in a mission involving a fake play and luring some redcoats into seeing it. Now, there are two things I love about this story. First of all, the splash panel where it's Tomahawk on stage just lifting a British army man over his head with the rest of them in the audience. Like Tomahawk just going apeshit on these redcoats, which I really enjoy. And then, obviously, the comparison is of my imagination. But the whole idea of crafting this fake play in a fake theater to lure the redcoats in and then basically massacre them is exactly the ending of Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, where they lure all the Nazis into the movie theater just to set it on fire. And it's the same basic idea. Now, because this was a 50s comic and violence couldn't be too extreme, there's a panel here where Dan Hunter is about to shoot one of the redcoats in the head with his rifle, and instead the bullet just skims over his head, as opposed to hitting him in the head and exploding it. And so it's kind of comical when you realize it's like, you know, these guys are trapped in a burning theater while these two Americans in coonskin caps are shooting at them. It's kind of a massacre, really.
This struck me also as like any 50s or 60s Western on television would do this plot, you know, where they have some kind of hijinks to get the enemy, whoever that enemy would be. But I do love the idea that Tomahawk and Dan liked the actors so much that they were going to give them money because they were about to get basically thrown out of the theater, essentially. And we can't return to the inn without money. But instead of that, he's like, you know what? I got an idea for you guys. And it's so wacky that basically they're doing a play about Tomahawk and he sneaks off in the middle of it, fights a bunch of redcoats, comes back, fights more redcoats, and then the story's over.
Tomahawk may be a woodsman, but he has an appreciation for the arts, which is nice.
You know, and that just makes him an all-around, you know, like more of a Renaissance man than just, you know, living out, you know, on the land. And, you know, I guess he could run a trout line, but, you know, he also likes the theater.
If he was around nowadays, he'd be supporting podcasts via Patreon or something. He'd be one of those guys, you know. So it's good. It's good. I like this Tomahawk fella. So the final story is The Battle of the Master Woodsman from Tomahawk number 45. Tomahawk finds himself on the opposite side of the war when an old friend of his, a tracker named Thacker, sides with the British. They agree to go their separate ways, but the war reunites them in a battle of life and death. This was probably my least favorite, but that's not saying much because I still liked it. It was kind of fun. I liked the idea that Thacker is not so much throwing in with the British. He's just sort of like, look, I don't have any real truck with them, so why should I fight them? And Tomahawk, of course, is the, you know, oh, what are you talking about? You can't do that. So I think that's a fun idea that just because somebody's on the opposite side of the war doesn't mean that they're a terrible person. You know, that's a nice humane touch. That they were fitting into this story. So, but again, it's probably the least exciting of the bunch.
Three things about this story. One, I love the moment because the beginning of the story is they're hearing that the war has started. So basically, they're all riding to enlist, but they get to kind of a literal like fork in the road, and it's at that point that Tomahawk realizes that Thacker is going to go in with the British, and I'm just like, wow, that's actually kind of interesting characterization for this type of story to kind of add that ambiguity, mm-hmm. like you were saying, that ambiguity that when you really look at the history of it, it wasn't that all of the people of the colonies suddenly got together and wanted to fight the British. There was dissension in the ranks from the very beginning. So it was kind of interesting to see that. Two, and actually two and three, but Thacker reminds me of two characters I've seen on different television shows. American Dad, at one point, they had through, I don't know if you watched the show.
No, I've never seen it. I mean, I'm familiar with it, but I've never
seen it. But basically, through shenanigans, he convinces his family that there's a nuclear war, and they find this woodsman who's been living off the land, and he's got this really loud voice, and they end up getting him married to a Jewish woman because it's a Seth MacFarlane cartoon. So he kind of looks like him, but it also reminds me of the episode of Highlander, the television series that will always make me laugh, was where Mark Singer was an immortal mountain man. And he kind of had the same beard, too. So that's what I kept thinking throughout this entire thing. Like, any minute now, he's going to start yelling like Mark Singer did throughout that entire episode. But the key to this issue, to this particular story, and why I kind of liked it, is that it wasn't, you know, while it was Tomahawk basically fighting the Redskins, it was basically two mountain men kind of playing chess. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, wow, that's kind of a neat hook to this story. So, again, you know, when we get to the end of this, I'm just like, you know, I've been making fun of this for years, and I'm not going to say, oh, I was so stupid, because it was a dirty, dirty lie on the part of DC Comics, and no one will deny that. And as recently as last year, I saw Mark Waid still complaining about it. But at the same time, if you actually sit down and read it, it's not a bad read at all.
No, not at all. So there's some nice touches here. The one on the last page of this story, when Thacker is slowly sinking into the water, and Tomahawk and Dan the Hunter climb a tree log and try and rescue him, there's a caption, and it says, abruptly. And the way it's drawn, it's not drawn in a typical box from left to right. It's drawn with a little swirly line as if the caption box itself is swirling into the water.
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that.
What a nice little touch to throw in. Like, that's a really meta kind of thing. All of a sudden, it looks like an EC comic. You know, like, that's whoever was doing this just decided to get a little fanciful and put it in. So, yeah, this is, as you said, this book is a dirty lie. And despite the fact that Superman told Lois that he never lies, this book is a lie. But like I said, it's way better than its reputation suggests, because, again, it's so easy to make fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, well, it's not Superman saluting the bicentennial. It's not him taking on Brainiac to, you know, to like save the life of George Washington or something. It's friggin' Tomahawk. But nevertheless, I'm getting an appreciation of why Tomahawk lasted as long as he did.
Yeah, and the one thing that the biggest thing that I took away from you and Shag doing the various Who's Who series, especially the original series, is that DC has this really rich history of characters. It hasn't always been all superheroes all the time, and especially in the 50s, before Barry Allen shows back up, and even through the 60s and 70s, they had war characters and Western characters, mm-hmm. and space characters. And I think a lot of that gets kind of lost in the superheroes, since they, you know, usually remain the dominant genre of comic books. But one of the other reasons why, when you asked me to do this, that I did it is like, okay, I have told myself that I'm going to read this stuff, that if the opportunity pops up, I'm not going to turn my nose up to it. If I come across like a Sergeant Rock story or a Adam Strange story, or, you know, even though Adam Strange is kind of a superhero, it was more of a science fiction thing, I'm going to give it a shot. And I'm so glad I did. The only disappointing thing about this, what was that character's name? Lord Shillington?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The bad guy, the main Tomahawk bad guy.
None of that in here. What the heck?
No. Yeah, we never see him, despite the fact that he got a Who's Who listing, which is pretty shocking.
And had like a thousand appearances in comics, too.
Yeah, that's weird. Geez, I didn't even really think about that, but yeah, you're right. That's kind of strange. There are some nice bonus features here. After the story's proper, we get two pages of Superman giving us the Bicentennial Planet, which is what the Daily Planet would have been like if it was covering the Revolutionary War. It's got Cornwallis surrenders, peace treaty with England signed, Continental Congress declares independence. So that's a nice little fun thing. And then on the inside cover is a bio of Fred Ray. Mm-hmm. and it gives his background. Now, he lived, he talked about that his drawings have been exhibited in the Smithsonian Institution. So, wow, good on you, Mr. Ray. He lived all the way until 2001.
Oh, good Lord.
So he really hung in there. And this is one of these guys that, like, retroactively, I kind of say it's a damn shame that he probably didn't know much about, like, whether there was fandom for him. Like, it would have been cool to see him at a comic book convention.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, probably would not. I mean, just for that Superman cover alone, he would have been famous. Like, he's drawn one of the great Superman images. But, again, this is one of these guys that, like, probably wouldn't be mobbed at a Comic-Con because he would have all this historical art that most people are like, I don't, you know, I don't care about this stuff. But, you know, it's like, no, he had a really great career and was a really terrific artist.
I like that the bio mentions that he lives near Valley Forge and that the historic Susquehanna River is in within sight. I'm like, yeah, Susquehanna. I heard that growing up constantly, especially when I lived up in Mountaintop, which was near Wilkes-Barre.
Yes. So,
which suffered a tornado recently, which freaked me out. Because that doesn't really happen in Pennsylvania all that much, but...
Well, welcome to global climate change.
Yeah, but global warming doesn't exist.
No, not at all.
But, you know, I had a family. My dad is a real kind of history buff. And so we would go to, like, Gettysburg or the Smithsonian or other places like that growing up because he had a real passion for it. So that's another reason why kind of seeing this kind of stuff brings me back to that, because you didn't grow up in Pennsylvania as, you know, and go through their school system and not go to certain places on school trips and such. And I always dug those, not only because it got you out of school for the day, but they were kind of cool to see.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I enjoyed all that kind of stuff. It was fun. This book, the final bonus feature that I want to talk about is really my main takeaway from this book. And it is the back cover. And it is a collection of the then presidents of the United States with little pictures of each president with their names and the years they served. And I will say this back cover, again, this is not something DC had to do. This was something they threw together as a bonus feature. I mean, you know, they could have just had a picture of Superman. It's kind of funny to get off track. It's kind of funny that considering how much Superman global hopped or time hopped, he never met Tomahawk.
That is weird.
Like, they never crossed over. They never did like a DC Comics Presents with him and Tomahawk. But anyway, part of my digression. But anyway, this back cover, this really was the Kickstarter of my interest in U.S. history, in particular presidential history. And I really made it a point to try and learn as many of the presidents as I can in the order that they served. It ends with, of course, since this book was published in 1976, it ends with Gerald Ford. But, I mean, my love of, like, presidential history continued, you know, long after I first read this book. I mean, it's over now. That's been destroyed. but for a while, I enjoyed it. And I've read books on Truman and FDR, obviously, and Herbert Hoover and Nixon, all this stuff. And I find it very fascinating. And so I actually have a color printout of this back cover on our refrigerator.
Oh, awesome.
Because every so often, Tracy and I refer to it where we were testing one another of like, okay, who served from then to then? Then to then, then to then. And so, yeah, I can see it as I sit here. So this little feature that DC threw in, some staffer, some poor woodchuck in the office that they were like, grab some stats and put these together. This was genuinely life-changing for me, this back cover. And so thank you, DC Comics, for doing this because you didn't have to do it. You could have thrown in a pinup. You could have put in anything in this back cover, but you made the effort to do it. And I appreciate it. And like, this is my favorite part of this book, is this back cover.
Several things. One, shocking that you would read anything on FDR. just shocking.
This might have been the beginning of it. Yeah.
Two, JFK kind of looks like Sean Hannity, and I think that would drive Sean Hannity crazy, so I'm glad of it. And three, as I get older, I kind of find myself more drawn to historical books on history as opposed to, you know, reading, I don't want to say comic books. I'm never not going to read comic books, but, you know, just...
Yeah, who are you trying to kid?
Yeah, but just trying to kind of get into the different, you know, like who they were behind, you know, behind the office, basically. And what I have found is if you start reading anything from, like, FDR up to pretty much the present, the number of times people cross in and out of things is just kind of amazing. You know, Nixon, you know, is considered, you know, Tricky Dick, and he resigned in 1974 in disgrace. But his the 1960 presidential election was pretty much the Bush-Gore of this of that era, where it was contested. Mm-hmm. And I love finding out those things. And the one other thing that I love finding out is that these people were human. Like, you know, they had foibles and maybe things that you don't quite agree with, but that doesn't make them not great men. You know, FDR had a lot of weird things going on there. He got us through the Depression and World War II. So, yep. You know, that doesn't it doesn't take away from anything. Well, except Andrew Jackson, but that's entirely, you know, that's beside the point.
So, yeah, I agree. I loved learning about all this stuff. This was all fascinating. I mean, to learn of all these presidents I had, like, never heard of, you know, or like the William Henry Harrison, who served, you know, 1 year, not even a year. He served like 3 months. I was like, what's that guy? You know, I mean, or the fact that there was a president that served two non-consecutive terms. Mm-hmm. I never knew that. So, I mean, this was back when comic books were trying to teach you something. They didn't think they were above that. And I really enjoy that. I think this would have been a great, and this would have been the kind of comic book that probably your teacher would have been okay with you having.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh yeah, you're learning stuff about the frontier days, and you're learning stuff about the president, and it's all about the bicentennial. This is one of those books that's famous, you know, within the annals of nerddom, easy to make fun of because it is such a bait and switch. Nevertheless, I have such a warm place in my heart for it because it really was genuinely life changing.
Yeah, and actually, I can bring Grover Cleveland back to Superman and MASH. There is an episode of Lois and Clark. It's the third episode where a man claiming to be Grover Cleveland comes to the Daily Planet office, played by Larry Linville.
Really? Yes. I had no idea. Oh, that's great. Oh, that makes me happy.
See, I can bring it all back to our shared interests.
Oh, it's perfect. That's awesome. I never knew he was on Lois and Clark. That's great.
It's a bit part. It was basically he's the crazy guy who he's just like Superman is definitely an alien entity. He comes from the planet Protex. And then it comes out that he thinks he's Grover Cleveland.
Interesting. Wow, cool. I never knew that. Well, learning something new. This book continues to instruct me in new things. It's amazing. One last detail I wanted to get into before we wrap up here is I did want to get briefly into the history of Tomahawk as a DC Comics character. He first appeared in Star Spangled Comics. He ran from numbers 69 through 130. That's a hell of a run.
Yeah.
Plus he was the title star in Tomahawk, which ran from numbers 1 through 130. Imagine that, 130. Then they did Son of Tomahawk, 131 through 140, which is a series I've gone on and on about. I think it's some of the best comics ever done. He also, on top of that, he had a run in World's Finest Comics, which ran from number 65 through 101. And that was all at the same time. So he was, at one point, he was in Star Spangled Comics and Tomahawk. Then they canceled Star Spangled Comics. Then he was in Tomahawk and World's Finest. So, I mean, this guy was in two different books at any given time, all throughout the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. So he was a genuine star for DC Comics.
Yeah, that's the thing about the way DC published their titles back then is that most of them were anthologies. So while Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and I will mention Aquaman and Green Arrow because they survived through the dark periods thanks to Adventure Comics and More Fun. But when you look at characters that are considered kind of I don't want to say gimmicks, but, you know, like no one really thinks of the Golden Age Vigilante as like a big deal. But he ran for years in Action Comics, and so did Zatara. So did Congo Bill. I mean, I think, you know, we're so caught up in our present day of how they do comics where, you know, you have a character, and if that character is successful, you kind of branch him off. And if he's Batman, you just give him five titles just in general at this point. But it's really interesting to think that kids reading comics in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there were probably like diehard vigilante fans and diehard, you know, like Starman fans or diehard Tomahawk fans.
Oh yeah, there had to have been. You don't keep a book for 130 issues without some dedicated fans. I mean, you just don't. That's it. That's an extraordinary run. So I mean, and again, I mean, putting him in the back of World's Finest comics, people were buying World's Finest for Superman and Batman, obviously. But nevertheless, a 36 issue run in World's Finest comics is nothing to sneeze at. You know, I mean, that's amazing. And so, and then after that, after Son of Tomahawk was canceled, he did not appear for another 12 years until he got a 3-issue backup in The Unknown Soldier. And I never knew about those stories until I did this research for this episode. And I was like, wait a minute, he appeared in Unknown Soldier. So I went and I got those comics. And I would love to say those three stories in the back are like these amazing little things. They're not. They're pretty dull. they're just pretty much standard Tomahawk stories. They're not done in any really new or interesting way. So I don't see how DC thought that this would maybe like, you know, reintroduce the character to another generation. They were pretty standard, and the fact that they did three and out, I think, suggests that it was, you know, didn't set the world on fire. And so that was pretty much it. His final appearance in a pre-crisis was in, of all places, Fury of Firestorm number 42, which was the Firehawk issue, which we covered on Fire and Water many, many years ago at this point. But yeah, that's, and then he showed up in Crisis. Post-Crisis, he was in Swamp Thing number 86, which baffled at that. I have not read that comic. And then he also got a one-shot from Vertigo Visions in 1998, another one I have not read. And that's pretty much been it for Tomahawk. But I mean, you know, he's around. DC's around. He's in the DC universe. They could use him again.
I almost want to say that he had an appearance in James Robinson's run of Justice League.
Well, that wouldn't surprise
me. Because there was a whole, like, flashback thing. Like, his first issue is, like, a Revolutionary War flashback.
Oh, okay.
So you have Bagley drawing, what was her name? The one Liberty Bell was the descendant of.
Oh, Miss America.
Miss America, who was killed by a falling. That thing is so horrendous to think about that that's how she met her fate. But there was I'm trying to think of what issue it was, but I remember seeing, like, there's this whole flashback thing of, yeah, he's in it.
Oh, my goodness.
Drawn by Mark
Bagley,
cool. Tomahawk and Dan Hunter.
Oh, that's great. See, they're still around. That
issue
makes me very
41
happy.
Of the post-Infinite Crisis Justice League of America. There you go.
Very cool. Oh, awesome. Nice job, Mike. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. That's great. Good to know that he's some writer can still use him if they want
to. Plus James Robinson. I mean, the man that used first issue special as a jumping off point.
This is the guy that shoved the Outsiders into one panel in the back of a Superman comic, so I shouldn't be surprised that he used Tomahawk at some point, for Pete's sake. So anyway, that's pretty much going to do it for Superman Salutes the Bicentennial. Again, what other book could we possibly talk about? I think I wanted to do this last year for the for the July 4th, and I just didn't get around to it, but luckily this year I scheduled far enough ahead, and Mike was nice enough to join me. So, Mike, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. And I don't know. I both feel like we have a greater appreciation for this book than we did when we started.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I was reading it at lunch today, and I'm like, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Perfect. Cool. And you see, you got it for $10. That's not a big price.
Not at all.
You know, it's a fun book. Absolutely. So, well, where can people find you on the internet?
I've made it really simple. FortressofHaleyTube.com. You can find all of my shows there. From Crisis to Crisis is back. Overlook Dark Knight, where's Andy Leyland and I talking about old Batman comics. Just old episodes of Views from a Long Box. Basically, anything that I haven't done with Two True Freaks is on there.
Very cool. All right. So everybody stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, we are going to do listener feedback.
Born and raised to make a kill. She was not given her own will. Her first hit left her feeling only disdain. She ran to Gotham's no man's land, learned from Barbara Gordon's hand. This starts the legacy of Cassandra Cain. Rising from the devastation of no man's land, a new warrior joined the Bat Family. Daughter of David Cain and Lady Shiva, trained from birth to be the ultimate killer, but choosing instead to save lives. She's been Batgirl, Black Bat, and Orphan. She is Cassandra Cain. Join Mike Staley as he goes through every appearance of one of DC's most underrated characters in Silent Night, the Cassandra Cain podcast, on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and at silentnight.podomatic.com.
Stay.
What?
Have you ever read a Superman comic?
Not in the last few hours.
Oh, I was just checking, right? Just checking.
Hey, everyone. My name is Michael Bailey, and I have been a fan of Superman for as long as I can remember. In 1987, I started collecting the Superman comics as a going concern, which led me down a long and winding comic book-filled path to 2007, when I first started podcasting. Well, it's 2017, and because it's been 10 years since I started podcasting, and 30 years since I started reading Superman full-time, I thought it might be fun to start a new show called It All Comes Back to Superman. It All Comes Back to Superman will be my monthly reaffirmation of my Kryptonian faith, where I will pick out something about the Man of Steel and discuss it. Sometimes I'll be alone. Sometimes I'll have a guest. No matter how many people get involved, Superman will be the focus. It All Comes Back to Superman is part of the Fortress of Baileytube Podcasting Network. New episodes will drop on the 28th of every month. This show and all of the other programs that are part of the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network can be found at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
And we're back with listener feedback, and we're talking about Treasury Cast episode 24, which was Rudolph's Summer Fun with Dan Greenfield from 13th Dimension. Robert Ward relays the information. Currently on eBay, Rudolph's Summer Fun is $40 plus shipping. You can also get it in a 5-issue lot, poor condition on some, $70 plus shipping. I have to say, that feels like a bit overpriced. I actually saw a Rudolph's Summer Fun at the East Coast Comic Con, where I met Dan Greenfield for the first time, and the guy was selling it for $20. Now, I already own a copy, so I didn't buy it, but $20, that still felt a little steep to me, but you know, $20 is something better than $40. That's ridiculous. So I wouldn't go either one of those listings. But thank you for the info, Robert. Chuck Coletta says, here's a 1982 conversation between David Letterman and Gene Autry. Imagine that, Gene Autry on the David Letterman show, who says Rudolph was his biggest hit song and also the biggest hit for Columbia Records by 1982, and it sold 12 million copies. It's gone on to sell more than 25 million, and until the 1980s, it was the second biggest record ever after White Christmas, another one of my favorites. And Chuck, of course, provides the video link, which you can see on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, for this episode, Treasury Comics number 24. Thank you, Chuck. David Gutierrez says, I'd like to see a more mature take on this. I've always considered Rudolph the John Holmes of reindeers, the Christmas Wonderland murders. Edo Boznar continues this train of thought. He says, so his nose isn't the only thing that's shiny and red? Sorry, man, couldn't resist. Edo, David, don't make me separate you two. Brian Linton says, great episode, gentlemen. I have to agree with Dan that the bicycle copter was problematic. I'm not an expert on reindeer anatomy, but I don't think their hind legs are capable of pedaling a bicycle. I would have liked to have seen Grover riding on a surfboard, which would have pulled through the sky. On second thought, that wouldn't have worked because Marvel would have sued DC, claiming that the character bore too much resemblance to the Silver Surfer. You know, you never know. People are very litigious at times. Thank you, Brian. Chris Franklin, my co-host in Superman Movie Minute, and does a bunch of other great podcasts here on the network, says, as a dad with kids who reads comics, I really do miss things like this. Thankfully, folks like Art Baltazar and Franco and others like them still manage to produce fun, kid-friendly content. a DC Tiny Titans trilogy would be cool and a no-brainer when Teen Titans Go to the Movies comes out later this year. Good suggestion, Chris. I'm sure DC will not take you up on it. Luke Giaconetti says, the treasure editions were mostly before my time, so I had no idea that this existed. So I very much enjoyed hearing about it, especially as I was listening while mowing the lawn. So a perfect summer activity. Thanks for the great show and looking forward to future episodes. Thank you, Luke. I think this is your first comment on Treasury Cast, so welcome. Martin Gray from Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, why would Rudy need a whirly bat? I thought the point was that he could fly. Rob, remember, the Melting Lady wasn't Tenny Henson's only Midnight the Podcasting Hour appearance. He drew the even better, what comes hopping down the bunny trail and unexpected. Christmas, Easter, truly Tenny was king of holidays. That's right, Martin. I completely forgot about that. Yes, Tenny Henson had an really interesting career. Not much in the superhero genre, but all the other genres that DC published. So thanks, everybody, for the comments. We really appreciate it. And as always, you can find back episodes of the show and leave comments there on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And finally, I want to thank everyone that retweeted the show over on Twitter, which is just at Treasury Comics on Twitter. Helps get the show noticed. So thanks to 13th Dimension, the 108 Sage, Black Vulcan 69, Too Old, Too New, Once Upon a Geek, Firestorm Fan, Classic JLA, The Mind of Scott X, Factory Mirror, It's Plastic Man, Maxo Romero, Hey Hetrick, Justice Trek, Kyle Benning, Siskoy, Tim Price 17, Germ Trinity, Ryan DLE 01, Geek Tweeters. So, again, thanks, everybody, for the retweets. I really do appreciate it. And big thanks to Michael Bailey for coming by for this special July 4th episode of Superman Salutes the Bicentennial. I've been wanting to get to this comic ever since I started the show, and I'm glad I finally got to do it for this year. It's always fun talking to Mike. He's one of my favorite people. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Back episodes of the show, again, on the network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're talking about treasuries always over on Twitter, at Treasury Comics. So, thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.